Okay, as always, we have a title slide. This will be our 14th class on the topic now of marriage and divorce as a subset of 1 Corinthians. So the photograph, my favorite one I think I've been able to find in all these weeks of working with 1 Corinthians, you can see somebody had a drone going in very high quality. That's the Acro-Corinth and all of its fortifications on the top that are from much later than 1st century area, but time frame, but has been developed throughout the ages. But you can see a lot better here, I think, what remains they have uncovered of the old city, which is not really all that close to the isthmus itself where the boats were coming through. So it's surprising to me that they were, you know, farther away, maybe using that mountain as a redoubt, you know, to run to in the case of invasion or whatever. But this is, of course, the city that Paul's writing to, an extremely troubled congregation, save for Laodicea or maybe Galatia. Those three vie for having the most doctrinal problems, moral problems, just generally, you know, not getting it, struggling with the world. Worldliness of the area in which they live in, and certainly this is true to this day and always will be. You can only work with the people who are in the culture where you are, and so whatever kind of people they are is where you have to start. And some cultures are just extremely degraded, and so getting going with them and trying to polish them into one of God's diamonds is just a very difficult thing. And so we're certainly having our problems now in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, they'd written a letter, they'd asked a number of questions, and so Paul is led by the Spirit to address them all. This morning, I'm going to take a little bit smaller chunk of Scripture, and I should mention originally I thought we would have three classes on 1 Corinthians 7. It's going to be certainly at least four now, maybe five, but as we're going along, this will be the only chart that I have this morning, trying to cover, you know, quite a bit of material still, and so I'm not going to have any other slides, but there will be an outline here and then some additional information I hope will be helpful for everybody. First, we've looked at early verses now. In verses 1 and 2, a foundation is laid that is going to then total 9 verses throughout the chapter. Concerning the things about which you wrote, it's good for a man not to touch a woman, but because of the porneia, because of porneia plural, because of sexual immoralities, because of every kind and type and variant of sexual illegality, because of sexual temptation, because the sex drive is so powerful, then let each man have his own wife, let each woman have her own husband. So as Paul begins to answer these questions, as he builds his house of sexual propriety and impropriety, he lays as his first foundation stone. Marriage is God's answer to the problem of fornication. It's God's solution to the problem then of this sex drive running amok and creating all the problems that it does, of course, down to this very day. So because of fornication, he said, let each man and or woman have their own spouse in verses 1 and 2. Then in 3 through 9, again, though he doesn't use exactly the same phrase, but because of fornication, this now is the lack of self-control, he legislates that you can never withhold sexual activity from a mate. If you decide to forego it, it should only be for a time. It should be for prayer. You're going to have purposes in this, but not everybody has Paul's gift. And if you don't have it, then you don't have it. You just can't pray for it and God will give it to you. You can't demand it. It's not going to be bequeathed. You either get it or you don't. Everybody has their own sexual proclivities, and that's fine. Yeah, they're all a gift from God. But because of that lack of self-control, they should come together again in the marriage. And then he summarizes it all by saying, it is better to marry than to burn. So before anything else is addressed, before anything else, you know, comes up in a particular case, he spends 9 verses saying sexual drives are very powerful. And that needs to be accepted. It needs to be realized. And then we're going to have Paul telling us that there are responses that ought to be made with regard to that very fact. So it's better to marry than to burn. Then in 10 and 11, we saw, don't divorce. It reads like this, to the married I give instructions, not I but the Lord, which means to those who are both Christians that are married, I'm going to tell you something now that did not or was not addressed by Jesus while he was here. I've got that backwards. Not I, but the Lord is to say, this is not new information you're getting from me, but the Lord said this. Well, we've already studied this back in the Gospels. We looked at Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Saw every one of those passages. And so Jesus gave this instruction already. And it is that the wife should not leave her husband. If she does leave, let her remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband should not send his wife away. So to those where both are devout, faithful Christians, this is the married group that we're talking about now, the wife should not leave her husband. But it happens. Happens a lot. It shouldn't happen, but it does happen. Like stealing sheep, theft should not happen, but it does happen. When it happens, legislation is given regarding stealing, regarding lying, regarding lots of things. And so we get this legislation as well here. The husband should not send his wife away, so it's same, same. But I want to emphasize something that maybe I haven't made quite so clear in this particular manner. Is I'd like for you to note that the earlier instruction in 10 and 11a still also applies in 11b. Paul does not lay down some principle and then immediately forget it and say, now the next group I want to talk to, what I've just said doesn't apply. He doesn't do that. He lays down a principle, and the principle stands. The principle is foundational. The principle is applicable. And so, because he goes on to talk about subsets of different people, he's not taking away the instruction that he's already made. Now, look what I mean specifically in 10 and 11a. You understand how these designations for scriptural designations are made. So, it's all of verse 10 and then the first half of 11. 10 says, to the married I give instructions, not I but the Lord, the wife should not leave her husband. But if she does, it's all feminine so far. It's the female viewpoint so far. The wife should not do this. But if the wife does this, then the wife should remain agamos. If she's divorced her husband, she becomes agamos. If she's murdered her husband, she becomes agamos. If the husband dies by her hands or somebody else's, she becomes unmarried. She should remain in that state or be reconciled. And the husband should not send away his wife. Well, now, of course, what's in 10 and 11a about the wife then must not be applied to the husband. Right or wrong? Wrong. Just because he doesn't elaborate on everything he said in 10 and 11a when he switches sexes does not mean that husbands are forever forbidden from leaving a wife. That happens to them too. Now, I say forbidden, it shouldn't happen, but it does. So they shouldn't do it, but they do. So in 11b, the husband should not send his wife away. Does that mean that under no circumstances may a husband ever divorce his wife? Does that mean that if she commits adultery, he can't divorce her? Does that mean, you know, that we should ignore everything in 10 and 11a because it isn't repeated in 11b when we talk about the husband? Well, of course not. Now, this is going to be very important to us, not only here, but very important later. Let's not be taking away Paul's advice, divine instruction, that's already been laid down, just because he doesn't repeat it for all six cases or types of marriages. When the foundation is laid, it remains there. It still applies. So what am I saying in 10 and 11? To the married I give instruction, not I but the Lord. The wife should not leave her husband. But if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled unless she doesn't have the gift that he's already spent 9 verses just immediately before 10 telling you it's still better to marry than to burn. So not only does 10 and 11a apply to 11b, but 1 through 9 still apply. to 10 and 11, A or B. We shouldn't take away previous instruction just because Paul is not so redundant as to repeat it every single time he talks to some different group. So it'll always be better to marry than to burn. That's the underlying principle. It'll always be better not to divorce, but if you do, remain unmarried, be reconciled, or if you haven't got Paul's gift, you're not condemned to a life of celibacy, which you don't have the gift to do. To avoid fornication, let each man or woman have their own spouse. Now, let's get to new material this morning, starting verses 12 through 16. I say new. We touched on this last week, but let's pick up through it again. 12 through 16. To the rest, that is, married couples who are not both Christians. So, this group, what he just calls the rest, are Christians married to unbelievers. I say not the Lord. Well, even as he had done back in verse 10, now he's reversing it though, he now says this information cannot be found in the Gospels. This information has never been addressed. Jesus did not address this topic. Now, I know in my own life I made severe mistakes in that regard. Because I used to look at people married to unbelievers and say, here over in Matthew 19 or over there in Mark 10 or in Luke 16, here's what God says to you. But in 1 Corinthians 7, he emphatically and specifically, undeniably says, Jesus never talked about this group of people. You cannot apply those verses in the Gospels to these people. They're not in God's mind in the Gospels. And for obvious reason, we don't have any Christians yet. We don't have believer-unbeliever circumstances. Why would Jesus, as a Jew under Moses' law, teach Jews under Moses' law what they should do if they're married to somebody who does not become a Christian? There aren't any Christians. Won't be Christians, for all this time. So that's important. And I was blurring those lines. And frequently, in fact, I think I would run back to Matthew 19 to try to teach things to people that the Scripture emphatically tells us don't apply to them at all. That's a pretty serious mistake. Believers in 12 through 16 who are married to unbelievers, it works like this. To the rest I say, not the Lord, if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever. Now you have your definition for the rest. She consents to live with him, let him not send her away. And a woman who has an unbelieving husband, he consents to live with her, let her not send her husband away. Well, here we go again. This time it's immediately male or female. We get, the corollaries. 14. The unbelieving husband is sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise, your children are unclean, but now they're holy. As I mentioned last week, all that means is if they don't get religious instruction, if they don't get biblical instruction from one or the other, then they're not getting any at all. So if they do get biblical instruction, they're sanctified in that manner. It's not a declaration of a final judgment or ultimate salvation, only that they're set apart in the sense that they have then, a believing parent to work with them. Now, 15. Yet, if the unbelieving one leaves. Well, here we go again. Well, what do you do if what we don't want to happen, what shouldn't happen, what we hope won't happen, happens? What then should we do? Well, let's not apply things that were never addressed. Let's not rush back to the Gospels to go get our answer. Let's not rush to some other passage. What do widows do? Let's just stick with this one. If the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or the sister is not under bondage in such cases. But God has called us to peace. A brother and I read whole books. I've got one signed by the author, where we talk about not under bondage. I've seen every argument, I guess, that's ever been conceived that here we are not talking about the marriage bond. We're talking about something else. And then once they determine, well, we can't be talking about the marriage bond because my views of marriage and divorce won't sync up with that, It must be some other bond. Then you get all kinds of varying opinions on what this other bond might be. But brethren, let me just ask. In verses 1 through 14, what other bond have we ever talked about? If it isn't a marital bond, what is the subject matter? There isn't any other bond in the context. And that's why there's so many varying opinions when they start inventing bondages that aren't marital bonds. Marital bonds are the only thing in the chapter. You abandon that, well, then, you know, you got to wander aimlessly trying to figure out some other kind of a bond. But this is a marriage bond. They can divorce and they can marry somebody else. Both parties. We wish it wouldn't happen. We're asking them not to do that. But if it does, then here's what you do. 15. If the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. The brother or the sister is not under bondage in such cases. But God has called us to peace. Imagine if you tried to stay married in this terrible circumstance. They're not content to live with you. You got all these problems, you know, and then you force this issue. That's not peace. No kind of peace in that. And then he elaborates, he explains what he's saying in 16. How do you know, oh wife, whether you'll save your husband? How do you know, oh husband, whether you'll save your wife? You don't. You can't ensure that. So let them leave. Now what do we have? If they consent, some have content. The idea is in verse 12. If they will accept your faith, if they will be agreeable mates, if they allow you to serve your God. Now, I've been up against this time and time again, brethren, throughout my preaching career, and I guess every preacher does. You baptize somebody, the mate does not become a Christian. I actually had a case where the husband did everything he could to prevent his wife from ever attending a Bible class. He got up early one Sunday morning, drained all the oil out of the car, and then refused to replace it. So at the moment when she comes out now to go take the car to worship, he says, you can't use it, there's no oil in it. Well, put the oil in. Well, I can't, I'm busy right now. So he just lies through his teeth to do everything he can to prevent her from getting to the assemblies. Is he consenting to live with her? Is he content to dwell with her? Should you give up your mate or your faith? Well, obviously. So when you don't have somebody that's content, somebody that consents, and they want to leave, let them go. You'll be better off. Remain unmarried or else be reconciled. Or if you don't have Paul's gift, then what? Should we abandon the first 9 verses? They don't apply here either. We quit using them in 10 and 11. Let's not use them in 12 through 16. Why not? Brethren, you don't throw away the foundation that you're building on. So if you have an unbelieving mate, they're not content at all. They're standing in front of your faith, trying to prevent you from being faithful. They want to leave. You don't say, okay, I'll attend fewer assemblies so I can keep you. I'll stop going to Bible classes so I can keep you. No, you don't. You stand up and say, well, I'm not content to give up my faith for this marriage. So I'm going to continue to be as faithful as I know how. And you've got a choice to make. I am not giving up my faith for you. Now, if they walk out, let them go. And you don't have to spend the rest of your life in celibacy, as so many of our brethren teach. Well, there is no fornication. So now, you can never marry again. Your mates mistreated you, abused you. I've told you the story before. Don and I, you know, I arranged a whole deal to rescue a woman one time. Contacted the police, a number of the men in the congregation, and we ran a military mission. Soon as her cocaine addicted, violent husband who beat her up all the time and was threatening to kill her with his weapons left for work, we descended on the house, took everything she owned, brought the family, 2 kids and her, to my house. And we had little kids, and they stayed with us for a total of 5 months. I just lived in terror that whole time. This guy was a maniac and a drug addict and violent and had guns. So I took the guns, a two-hour drive, I guess it was, up to his mom's house at the Canadian border, and figured at least when he got home, if he ever was able to figure out where she'd gone, well, then he'd have to go to his mom's house to get his guns, and maybe he'd cool off in that length of time before anybody would get killed. Now, brethren, is she now condemned to a life of celibacy? No, of course not. That's just unthinkable to me now, but it used to be so plain. Yeah, sorry. You're going to have to live the rest of your life without a mate. Now, never mind. He tried to kill you. He's abusing you and the kids. You fled for your life, you know, but you're going to have to live celibate the rest of your life. I'm sorry. Young woman, you know, you can't have a husband for the kids. Brethren, I just don't believe that anymore. I think the foundations that have been previously laid apply. So believers should stay married to unbelievers. If the unbeliever leaves, you're not under bondage. If you're not under bondage, then you're agamos. And if you're agamos, then the instruction will be prior and after this passage the same. You don't have the gift, then get married. Note, the earlier instruction in 11a also applies here. We've already had this instruction. He doesn't have to repeat it again. So in 11a, if she leaves, let her remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. That's a principle that's been laid down after the principle that it's better to marry to burn than to burn. And all three of those options now apply in 15. If the unbelieving one leaves, let him leave. Remain unmarried if you can. Be reconciled if you can. And if you can't, it's better to marry than to burn. You're going to carry these instructions forward and not abandon them just because they're not repeated in every verse. So verses 1 through 9 still apply to the mixed divorcees too, just like the others. Yes?
I have a question on the example that you gave of the fact that you guys had to swoop in and say, pull this woman out of this bad situation. She technically was the one who left him. So unless he gets a divorce, she would have to remain separated?
I don't think so. I do not think that anybody has to give up the right to marriage because of an unbeliever abusing you. It is still better to marry than to burn. So obviously, the believer has more incentive to want to stay in the marriage. But they can flee for their lives and that of their children, which is what we were doing here. And in my opinion, it's still better to marry than to burn, whether she initiates the divorce or not. I've had long conversations with people on this. I've actually had some of the kind of leaders in this say, I know. I mean, they just hang their heads and they admit, I know, it sounds ridiculous to say that a woman flees for her life, innocent as she can be in every sense, faithful to her God, protecting her children, and now she's condemned to celibacy because the guy is a cocaine addict who wants to kill her. They know that sounds crazy. There's a reason why they hang their heads. It is crazy. That's not what God is dealing with right here. We get so caught up like the Pharisees in tithing, mint, and dill, and coming, we forget justice. We forget these other principles. So, brethren, it's still better to marry than to burn. Fornication, temptation is still out there. For that matter, the kids still need parents. No, I don't think somebody who fled a marriage for their lives has to then say, well, my evil husband has condemned me to a life of celibacy, even though I don't have Paul's gift. Now, I got three hands up. I'll go in order. Saber first.
I lost it. I can't get it.
Okay, well then somebody else, here it is. Go ahead.
I think that she can leave, but I also think that she should get a divorce so that everything is legal on paper and everything else, and then she can marry because she, although she left, it was for her own safety, but she doesn't have to live with him. But if you don't, if you're not divorced from him, it seems to me like she should be the one that gets the divorce because then she can go forward.
I think it matters who gets the divorce. It's not who runs to the courthouse first. You're absolutely right. She can initiate a divorce. Was he content to live with her? He's trying to kill her. Is that content? No. Well, now, he didn't go off and get a divorce. She did. Well, what's the difference? He wasn't content. It's not a matter of who gets the paperwork first. It's not a race to the courthouse.
Can I come back? It's a cautionary tale. It's a cautionary scripture. You've got to think about the character you're marrying and your lives together before you do it, or else you're responsible, and that's the rest of the society as we see deteriorate.
Yeah, all true, but I suspect that these verses are not talking about somebody before they got married and then consciously deciding to marry an unbeliever. It's more likely one of them converted. They were both unbelievers. They got married, and then one of them converts. See, so now they've got a problem. They used to be of that deranged mind, you know, worldly mind too. Now they've abandoned it, but the mate hasn't. So now the problem arises after they had been married. Jimmy already had her say. Okay, so Carol?
I'll withdraw.
Okay. Okay. All right, we'll talk about it afterwards. Brother, I'm going to be totally available to discuss it at any length you like. I know this is hard. I believe it's hard primarily because it is always hard to accept a new position. It was very hard for me. 23 years, I thought, this has to be so. Everybody believes it. I believed it. It all looked solid. And then it took me some study to realize, wait a minute, there's things that just aren't adding up. And then I was able to keep all those things in my head and realize when I said this, I was contradicting that. When I said that, I was contradicting this. But before, I'd never realized that I was. So as I've said, nobody should be changing anything. Please, just keep studying. And all your questions, I'd be more than happy to study. Vicki, I think, in the back.
I was just going to say, that doesn't sound that crazy to me for her to have to remain single. Why, for the rest of her life, why does that sound so crazy to you?
Because it's better to marry than to burn. And then just to say, well, I'm going to practice the doctrine of demons instead and forbid marriage, it seems crazy to me. Okay. Well, it's Carl's turn, I think, now. Yeah, you guys in the front can't see the back. Carl, what have you got? Hmm?
Say, brother, you mentioned burning.
Okay, you have to speak up. I have my hearing aids in, but I still have trouble up here. Go ahead.
The burning in this conversation seems to be more appropriate in hell rather than passion. And we need to...
In what rather than passion?
So that we won't burn in hell.
No, it's not that at all. And for a variety of reasons. Brother, I'm going to be extremely bold here and just go ahead and tell you. I haven't taught eternal torment since 1989. I stopped believing it in 1995. It's a Catholic doctrine I grew up with, and we can trace its roots to that. I do not believe in an eternal torment. I believe in an eternal punishment. I do not believe in eternal torment. The classic vision of hell is Catholic to the core and as unbiblical as it can get. But it's deeply rooted among us as well. I know that. So it's probably rocked your whole world for quite a few of you. We'll, you know, hope we might get into that one day. And we'll touch on it in Matthew 25 this morning. I don't believe it. Okay? So fess up. I also know there's a lot of other guys who don't believe it. And the older you get, and very often has been the case, the less you believe it for a wide variety of reasons. The principal reason, brethren, is that the passages that use that expression are speaking of the fall of Jerusalem. And they say so in the context. But because we forget, overlook, or even deny the context, we then apply them to eternity and to certain groups of people that I think we shouldn't. Now, that's got little to do with 1 Corinthians 7, except to say the burning here is of a sexual nature. It's not talking about a final judgment. That's just not in the context. Okay. Carol, you remember?
Does the idea of baptism seem crazy to you?
You know, it didn't to me because I didn't have a background when I came to it. I just read the Bible and there it was, and so I went looking for somebody to baptize me. It seems absolutely insane to the vast majority of the world. Freely grant, for the great majority of the world, it's just, you got to be out of your mind to think that baptism is necessary for salvation.
I agree with that. If a person is divorced or other, you and I are in agreement on this part, I think, if they are divorced for a reason other than fornication, pornea, does sin occur?
It does.
And sin always, always carries with it consequences. Grave and ugly and terrible consequences.
Amen.
So in a situation where you're talking about you give a story here of this person who's fleeing a terrible husband, and I agree she should flee for her life, but that doesn't mean that she has to divorce him. She doesn't have to live with him. She doesn't have to. But unless there's fornication there and she divorces, is there sin?
I don't think so.
You don't? So if no. He can divorce for less than fornication because she's being threatened.
He can divorce?
She can be divorced because she's being threatened without sin.
Yeah, and it's less than fornication if he's not content to live with her, too.
Well, we're not talking about it. We're talking about your example. The point is that better to marry than to burn just does not apply because in a case where there are unmarried virgins, those things which I believe were addressed over here, but this does not apply to your illustration here. If a person divorces for other than fornication, you've already said sin occurred, and if sin occurs, there are terrible, ugly consequences, which means there are children who will be left without a father, without a home. Is it good? Do we like that? Do we want that? No, it's terrible, but it's a consequence of sin, a necessary consequence if children exist there. You just can't move it around and it applies here and it doesn't apply over here.
Okay, well, what I'm saying is there are always ugly, horrifying, terrible consequences to sin, as you've said. Okay, I just don't want to add any extra ones that God doesn't.
Well, but God does. It's you that have said that I just can't see that. Well, some people say that I just can't see this about baptism. It's crazy. It doesn't make sense. It's still the way God outlined it.
Perhaps. Or else the first 9 verses still apply. That's the question that every one of you has to decide. To whom do we deny the principles of the first 9 verses? And if we do, you know, then how do we address the fact that condemning someone to a life of celibacy originates with demons? It's a doctrine of demons. Who are we going to apply that to?
We did not condemn her.
Pardon me?
We, as individuals, do not condemn her to a life of celibacy.
You're saying God did. So God, who identifies this as a doctrine of demons, now says you must practice this doctrine of demons. That's a problem for me.
Well, it would be be if I was the one, in which I would never do, condemn one or someone or tell someone that they could not be married. I can show them the scriptures what God said. And you can do this your way or you can do it God's way. But the end result is going to be his determination. He condemns, I don't.
Yeah, I did the same thing for years, and I accused no one of anything but myself. One day I reached the conclusion that I was really dodging the issue with that argument. It just didn't add up. So I can blame it on God if I want, but it's God who told me this is a doctrine of demons. I rather doubt that he's now endorsing it. For the same reason, you know, I don't believe God ever changed his marital laws, brethren. That's my view. God does not act capriciously. You can depend on him. You can count on him. So when he lays down these principles, you can trust him. That he's not then, I think, arbitrarily, as I used to do, say, well, because he didn't repeat them in 10 and 11, then they don't apply. Because he doesn't repeat them in 15, they don't apply. Because he never addresses the case where you fled for your life, then they don't apply. Now, it's certainly true that you cannot find a passage that says, what should you do if your mate's trying to kill you? I freely grant, there is none. But I don't think that means that God says, so you're on your own, good luck with that. I think it's printed in the first 9 verses, in the next 2, and in every verse in 1 Corinthians 7. This is what I'm saying. My view is consistent. It embraces everything God said. Instead of saying, well, God says life of celibacy is a doctrine of demons. And he endorses that for millions and millions and millions of people who got divorced without committing adultery. They're totally innocent, served God faithfully as they could, mate divorces them, and they've never committed adultery. It's incompatibility. So the doctrine of demons applies to the majority of the people in America today. And I say, yeah, that's hard for me to swallow. Since it's printed on the page in 9 verses that it's better to marry than to burn, and saying you can't marry is a doctrine of demons. That's where I now stand. I think my view is much more consistent. God never said, what should you do if your husband wants to kill you? But he did say it's better to marry than to burn. Okay? Carl, yeah, go ahead.
Than to burn, not to burn with passion. Like this version of American King James from 1982. This one, New American Standard from 1960, dates don't matter. But they do both say with passion.
Yeah, yes.
And you mentioned burn.
Yeah, probably in italics too.
Yes.
Yes. So the translators all recognize this as well. And so as Carl's pointing out, when you look at various translations, you'll find several that add the words with passion to clarify Saber's question. Is this talking about burning forever in the fires, you know, of eternal torment? No, it's not about sexuality. So they add the words with passion and not
so
in him.
You're saying it does refer to with passion.
Certainly, they're correct in adding those because they see it in the context. They see it in the nature of the verbiage.
Okay. Looks like one of Diane's cats are out of the bag.
Okay, it's not even near to hear that.
Not there being, but as Jesus said, brood of vipers, how are you going to escape the condemnation of hell? So maybe sometime you could clarify it.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. And, you know, it's way beyond our purview here, but let me just say, you need to do some Bible study, brethren, and it took me quite a few years to get it done. You can do this now, particularly because everybody's got online access. Every imaginable Greek study tool is available to you for free. Okay? That word that gets translated, hell, is very unfairly translated from 2 different words. They're all together different words. And then the translators come up with hell, and hell means nothing. It's not translating the words. It's just a new word that we now have inserted to which we apply our Catholic doctrine, that it means eternal torment. So look them up. You got 12 occasions. But Hades does not mean the place where you go to eternally burn. Doesn't mean that. Gehenna doesn't mean that either. And usually hell is a translation from Gehenna, though sometimes it's Hades. And they don't tell you. Two totally different words. They also don't show you the passages that indicate, with time references, that what's going to happen is going to happen in their generation. So it's not final judgment. Okay? But
you know that the rich man who knew Lazarus was pretty hot.
I understand Luke 16, and I taught that when we were back in the Gospels. So I brought it up, you know, while we were there. Okay? Let me try to at least finish this much smaller portion. Okay, so I hope I'm not overlooking too many people. You know, I'm down to 5 minutes now, so let me just get this. In 17 through 24, I'm highlighting remain in whatever, that remain in whatever, marriage included, condition in which you're called, is the single longest section of information in the book. And we'll have a total of 18 verses on this topic. But here in 17 through 24, we've got 8 verses on this topic. So let's just try to run out the clock with this. 17. Only as the Lord has assigned to each, remember he's also assigned whether or not you've got the gift. Paul's gift, some have it, some don't. God's doing the assigning there. As the Lord has assigned to each one, as God has called each, called by the gospel to become Christians, in this manner let him walk. Thus I direct in all the churches. Was any man called circumcised? Now let's stop. Why is 17 there? Because he's talking to the rest, starting in verse 12. Married to unbelievers. Only as the Lord has assigned to each, as God has called each, in this manner, let him walk. Now, before we go any farther, brethren, do some people marry and divorce and marry somebody else before they become Christians? Are these people never discussed in this chapter? Do these verses exclude them? So we have no instruction from God on what you're to do? No, brethren, I don't think I parcel these things out so carefully, like, you know, the Pharisees with their seeds, that I was leaving people out and overlooking justice and mercy and broader principles that are stated at great length in this chapter. So he's talking about the marriage as well as the illustrations that he's giving. The extra illustrations with regard to circumcision and slavery are added as illustrations in the context of questions they asked about marriage. These additional illustrations shed light on the marital relationship. Paul does not, in verse 17, abandon all thoughts of marriage and divorce and remarriage and go off to talk about circumcision, wander around in that in slavery for a while, and then come back to marriage. This is not Bible study in its context. The illustrations that he offers are helping us to understand marital relationships. As the Lord has assigned to each, you're in your second or third marriage when you're baptized into Christ, as God has called each, in this manner let him walk. And thus I direct in all the churches. Was any man called circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Anyone been called in uncircumcision? Let him not be circumcised. Circumcision's nothing. Uncircumcision's nothing. What matters is the keeping of the commandments of God. Let each man remain in all conditions except the marital condition in which he was called. Now, brother, you know verse 20 doesn't say that, but I applied it that way for a long time. I just wrote the exception clause for God, who should have put it in there, I thought. I thought I could find it elsewhere. Something wrong here that God decided not to write it, so I just inserted it. Let each man remain in the condition in which he's called, unless we're talking about marital conditions. No! Marital conditions is the whole point. 21. Were you called while a slave? Don't worry about it. If you're able also to become free, rather do that. He who was called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he who was called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought with a price. Do not become slaves of men. Brethren, let each man remain with God in that condition in which he was called when you're called to Christ. Now concerning virgins. Now, I'm going to add some more here in just a minute. I haven't heard the bell, so let me just jump to 27. We'll come back and we'll do it again next week. But we'll jump to 27. Are you bound to a wife? Don't seek to be released. Are you released from a wife? Don't seek a wife. Before or after you become a Christian, brethren, why do we keep taking away the principles he's already laid down when we go to the next verse? The adjoining verses do not abandon the principles he's already laid down. Are you bound to a wife? Don't seek to be released. A divorce, don't do that. Are you released? You already been through one. Or you're a widower. Or you're a virgin. Well, you couldn't be, in this case, you can't be a virgin. The word requires a previous marriage. I'm sorry, I misspoke. Don't seek a wife. But if you should marry, you have not sinned. I told people they had. But you haven't. I told them the doctrine of demons applies to you and God says so. But 28 says if you marry, you've not sinned. And if a virgin should marry, she has not sinned. Such will have trouble in this life, and I'm trying to spare you. 27 and 28, brethren, involves 1 through 9, 10 through 24. All these principles remain in place. So virgins and widows and divorcees should stay unmarried. And the earlier instruction still applies because 27 and 28 say so. It's written on the page. Okay, class dismissed.